Welcome to Silvacast, the podcast about all things silviculture. My name is Brad Hutnick.
And I'm Greg Edge.
We're both silviculturists with the Wisconsin DNR Division of Forestry and your hosts for today's show. Spring is in the air, Gregor.
Yeah, I guess it is, Brad. That's what I heard. But I'm referring to your hometown as spring green and mine is spring white because...
Yeah.
I've been shoveling for like the last week, so yeah, still waiting for spring here is the final.
You make it sound like a cross is near the Arctic Circle somehow.
It is. It is way further north than spring green.
Yeah. No, it's barely north from spring green. I think you're just tired of shoveling. I think that's what it is. So I think of spring now because I saw my first robin. Mm-hmm. I heard a couple sandhill cranes going over. And I've had geese flying over really low for a long time.
Yeah, that's true. The birds are migrating up the Mississippi here. So there are cranes, swans, a lot of geese, a lot of ducks. Things are moving.
And here in spring green, I think the surest sign is when, like, you start on my run at night, it seems like there are just bags on maples all over town now. So it's the people are getting ready. That's a sure sign of spring.
That's the thing I like about spring green. You know, people are real down to earth. They're sticking sap bags on their boulevard trees. They're making airplanes in their backyards. And just you don't know what you're going to see when you go there.
Hey, and we're not maple bigots either, right? I mean, we've got sugar maple, Norway maple, box elm, you name it.
You're not fussy. Is that what you're saying?
No, and actually, I read a term. We're going to rebrand spring green syrup. We're going to call it candied tree blood. I think that's got legs. I think we could.
I don't know. It just does not sound like a great marketing tool.
Well,
to me.
I don't know. You know, it's kind of interesting though when you think about marketing and all that. That at one point the maple syrup industry was like in decline.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember when I was a kid, I don't think I knew anybody that really tapped maples. Did you guys tap maples?
I didn't personally. I did help friends, and I'm just going to give a shout out to Rick Livingston, our friend and fellow forester, because when Livingston and our kids were the same age, we used to go over to a farmhouse they rented and help them tap, you know, just the old buckets and pour it into a big pan over the fire. But it was fun.
I agree. It is fun when you know people who have the evaporator and you're just sitting around. I think it's a great time. So for me, it's just... It's one of those things. There's always things changing. So it's hard to believe that we didn't have a big, like my experience with sugar maple when I was a kid was nothing. And now it seems like everybody's doing it. And I think as foresters, it seems like we're getting questions. It seems like everyone with a maple stand now is kind of thinking, hey, should I be doing sap production or maybe I should be making maple syrup?
Well, we've certainly been getting more questions and especially about sort of that intersection about what's the best silviculture to apply to sugar bushes. And I'll be honest, I really haven't learned this stuff and I don't feel really strong in that area of giving specific silvicultural advice for this. And you pointed out that there was a recent UW Extension survey looking at maple sap and syrup producers. And I think part of that is going to show that people do feel like there's a knowledge gap there around silviculture, about managing for invasive species, forest health issues. I think it's an important topic as this industry becomes bigger. And silviculturally, I think we have some things to figure out.
I agree. Well, to help bring us all up to speed on the silvicultural implications of maple syrup production, our guest this week is Mark Isselhart. Mark is the University of Vermont's Extension Maple Specialist. Since 1995, Mark has been immersed in maple sugaring research with the University of Vermont's Extension and the Proctor Maple Research Center. Here's my pun. It's going to be a sweet episode. And now, a word from our sponsors.
Today's episode of Silvcast is brought to you by the Nelson Paint Company. Since 1940, foresters all over North America have relied on Nelson Paint for tree marking solutions. Nelson Paint manufactures paint designed to withstand the harshest weather conditions in the field, and the Nelspot tree guns have lasted the test of time. Visit nelsonpaint.com to learn more about their products.
And now back to the show. Mark Isselhart, welcome to Silvacast. Now, before we get started, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Brad and Greg. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Like you said, my name is Mark Isselhard. I'm the maple specialist with University of Vermont Extension. I'm based out of the Proctor Maple Research Center, which is in Underhill, Vermont, sort of the western slopes of the Green Mountains, north central Vermont. And incidentally, that facility just celebrated 75th anniversary of doing maple research. So I've been here for a long time, not 75 years, but I've been there a long time, and happy to be part of this really interesting topic. So I grew up in southwest Vermont, a town called Bennington, went to local public high school, got interested in natural resources through a summer academic program called the Governor's Institute, which was essentially a couple of week program where high school students get to go stay at a college campus and learn about various topics. Mine happened to be about natural resources. It's when I really first learned how to identify trees, how to learn about other topics. And when I went back for my senior year, I wanted to learn more. As you might imagine, there wasn't a whole lot of natural resources information in the college prep sort of curriculum. Mm-hmm. But there was a natural resources class in the tech center. And so after having to actually fight to be able to take that class, I was able to take it and moved on from there, went to University of Vermont for forest management, and then ended up with a degree in master's degree in plant biology, focused primarily on maple syrup. It's really looking at non-structural carbohydrates and sugar maples and the effect of different levels of sap extraction.
Brad, I think you mentioned it earlier to me. Mark is maybe our third guest from Vermont.
Yeah, Mark, you're in the trifecta.
Yeah. So Vermont's small, but we keep pulling people from there. So,
well, definitely in terms of maple, we produce half the U.S. crop. So, kind of punch above our weight class, if you will,
really?
in terms of the maple.
Well, I think this conversation is going to be timely for us because it's just about the beginning of sugar season here in Wisconsin in the upper Midwest. And usually this means that foresters, this is when we get questions, when people are sitting around the evaporator or they're thinking about these things, they'll call a forester or they'll bring a forester in to ask about management for the future. And Greg, I think this kind of for us kind of hits at that definition of what is silviculture, right? So, and it's kind of important for us to keep in mind that we talk about silviculture being the practice of controlling forest composition, structure, growth, stuff like that to maintain and enhance the utility of the forest for any purpose, not just timber production, but for everything else. And so maple syrup is a great example of that.
And I'm really excited about this conversation, Mark, because I think I told you my education in sap production and managing sugar bushes feels completely inadequate, like nothing. Yeah. And so as a forester, I've gotten these questions over the years and just not felt like I really knew enough to give good silvicultural advice, you know, other than adapting silvicultural techniques we use for other purposes. So just having a discussion in this area is really important to me.
I mean, I don't think that's unique, Greg. I think that maple, first of all, we should define, you know, what maple sap syrup is. It's a non-timber forest product. And so we're harvesting something from the tree, not the tree itself. Of course, people who understand what maple is get that. But when you actually go deeper and start thinking about management, it has real implications. It's not surprising to me that you wouldn't learn it in your forest college curriculum. You know, I didn't really learn much about maple when I was studying forest management. And you can argue that there's a lot of similarities between managing a northern hardwood stand for clear straight boards, but there's also ways in which it's fundamentally different. And I think that layered with the fact that we're dealing with a perennial plant that has extremely long life, it makes it challenging for research. And so we can't do like an annual crop or something, a quick rotation to do the research to show what these different management strategies might do. And what you're left with is, you know, a largely wild forest managed to some degree, but the impact of some decision in terms of managing the vegetation, it's hard to get the signal from what, you know, prescription A versus prescription B might accomplish. Mm-hmm, yeah. So non-timber forest product, really important fundamentally. The other thing I'll say is that maple is this odd amalgam of agriculture and forestry. And historically, maple was made by farmers. If you look at the U.S. production of maple syrup, we produced way more syrup in the U.S. 100 years ago than we do now, which seems hard to believe. But if you think about it, there were thousands and thousands more farms than there are now. And if each one produced a little bit of syrup, you add that all up, you have a big pile of syrup. And what we saw with the period of farm abandonment, dramatic decrease in number of farms, we saw a dramatic decrease in the amount of maple production. And then you have this period between, let's say, the early to late 50s through 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, where maple production in the U.S. was fairly static. It was a little volatile, but it was pretty flat. It wasn't until the late 90s, early 2000s, you really start to see an increase in production. And we're seeing dramatic increases over the last 25 years. Yeah. And I think what you're seeing is the conversion from, there's still plenty of farmers who do it, but the large scale operations that are sort of more common now, these are people who don't have a dairy farm, who don't have other farm products. They're just doing maple and then maybe another career on the side.
That's what leads to these questions then for foresters and for us. And so that's just makes this conversation all the more timely.
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, it's kind of in this world between agriculture and more traditional forest management and sometimes has gotten lost, especially for, I feel that way as a forester.
The other thing I think that's really important beyond defining what it is the production practices and how those have changed. There has been a tremendous change in what practices are used to produce the bulk of the crop. There's still thousands of sugar makers who use buckets, maybe sap bags, you know, modest practices that would be, that are as effective as they were 100 years ago. But newer operations are using tubing, using high vacuum and other technology. And the productivity of any individual tap or tree has gone up dramatically. And I think what little bit of silvicultural knowledge exists is largely rooted in the old fashioned, what we call gravity or bucket sap collection. There really hasn't been a modern approach to silviculture using tubing and high vacuum.
Well, maybe we could, I don't know, maybe we'll back up a little bit. We'll just do a couple of quick hitters here about like some real basic questions, kind of set the stage. And then I think we'll kind of build on and kind of try and get into maybe some of what you were talking about, maybe some of these silvicultural implications of the things. So first question, and these are just things, and I have to admit, just like Greg, I'm like, I had to read a lot about this.
Yeah,
like,
these are SAP questions for dummies is what Brad and I labeled them.
So, happy to hear them.
Yeah. So first off, is minimum diameter, what would be a minimum diameter that we would look at in trees for sap production?
So generally speaking, 10 inches DBH would be the minimum. There are people who tap smaller trees. And to my knowledge, there are guidelines and recommendations, but there are no actual laws that say you can't tap a small tree. What we do know is that the relationship between diameter and sap yield is fairly linear. And so as you go large in diameter, you get more sap. And it does start to curve a bit as you get into the very large trees to maybe even potentially 3 feet in diameter. But the vast majority of trees being tapped are going to be smaller than that. And so the one thing I'll say, not to go back to the historical, but tapping guidelines, how many taps per tree you put in, those are largely rooted in bucket sap collection as well. Because with modern high vacuum and tubing, you can get a lot more sap out with fewer holes in the tree. With gravity, just a bucket, you're limited by how many hours above freezing you have on that given day. If you don't get the sap out, that's production you've lost for that season, depending on how the weather goes. And so when you see guidelines, 2, 3, 4 taps per tree, those are really just rooted in using buckets and are probably not sustainable long-term.
And you mentioned that relationship between sap and the diameter kind of being fairly consistent. Is it the diameter that's important?
It's largely the diameter. We're talking about conductive tissue. We're talking about how much wood, xylem tissue is available to be the reservoir of sap. The sap flow mechanism works anytime during the dormant season when the tree is exposed to temperatures and the stem is thawed out enough to allow for sap flow. You get a freezing event, this huge drawing up of moisture into the above ground parts. And then the next day or whenever it thaws, you're collecting under gravity, you're collecting sap that's flowing down from above. And then there's a bit of gas expansion to also increase pressure. And so the larger the reservoir in terms of above ground biomass, the larger the amount of sap you can collect. Lots of caveats, lots of footnotes to mention about that, but that's kind of the thing. The crown does play a part, but not nearly as much.
Mark, is sugar content for those individual trees important? And can you change the sugar content of a tree by, say, expanding the crown or whatever, or is that a fixed thing?
So predecessors of mine worked at this facility, the Proctor Maple Research Center, did years and years of work looking at sugar content of individual trees. What they found is that the relationship, say we were all trees in the forest, we had our inherent relative sweetness. I don't know you guys well enough to know who's the sweetest of the bunch, but let's just say that one of us is, and our position relative to each other would largely stay the same throughout our lives. The numbers might rise and fall based on environmental conditions, all sorts of things, but our position relative to each other in terms of sweetness are fairly well fixed. You can do things in terms of maximizing crown, which can help, but it's not a one-to-one. It's the relationship is driven a lot by genetics, which explains some of this relative position in terms of sap sweetness. But there are some management things you can do. It's sort of an indirect, if you build a larger crown, there's more photosynthetic capacity. Therefore, you'll probably get a little bit sweeter sap. There are a lot of confounding factors too that can mask or obscure some of that signal. But in general, larger trees, big crowns will have more sap and generally sweeter sap.
Would that be the key to looking for? Can you pick out, like just looking at a stand, can you walk in and say, oh, that's a sweet tree and that one isn't as much?
No, it's really challenging because we understand that this underlying relationship exists between individual trees in the forest, but to understand which one is the sweet one, which one isn't, or which one is less sweet consistently, you actually have to collect some sap. And the relative sap sweetness is so dynamic, both throughout everything from within the day, it can rise and fall, within the season, and then from year to year. And so it makes testing really challenging. You have to do it in a small group and then make management decisions based on that small grouping of trees. You can imagine you test one tree at 8 a.m, you test another one at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. You can't make decisions based on that last tree compared to the first tree because things have changed so much during the day. And so any guidance and research that was done to make these kind of selections were really done at a time before reverse osmosis or membrane sap concentration was a thing. And because there was interest in managing for the sweetest trees possible. But if we say 10 inch in diameter is kind of your starting point, it takes a long time to grow a 10 inch sugar maple. Yeah. And so once this technology we call reverse osmosis, which essentially pre-concentrates the sap, once that became viable, a lot of the research and sort of management focus on identifying individual sweet trees and focusing on them has kind of dropped off. Not completely, but it's much easier to buy this equipment that can get your sap sweetness higher. Most people would love to have an overall sweeter sugar bush, which is a collection of trees for the purpose of tapping. Most people would love to have a sweeter than average sugar bush, but when you actually get down to the nitty gritty and talk about what's involved in getting there, I think most people are going to invest in this reverse osmosis technology.
Does that open up the world then to like the other maple species?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we are seeing primarily red maple. If you look at the distribution, the natural range for sugar maple and red maple, red maple is much more of a generalist. It can handle sites that are a little wetter than sugar maple would tolerate, drier. Again, not that they love it, but they're able to compete better than sugar maple. There's been a long history of excluding red maple and really focusing on essentially a monoculture of sugar maple. When we survey for professional foresters, that's species diversity is one of the most concerning issues that they raise. You know, I think if I remember my data correctly, it was about a third of the foresters we asked cited species diversity was a concern about managing for maple sap production. But now we know more about red maple. My colleague, Dr. Abby Vandenberg, who is a research professor here at UVM, she has done the work to actually look at sap sweetness and sap volume from red maples compared to sugar maples. And while the red maple sap may be lower in concentration, when you factor in a season-long volume of sap, those two species are quite similar. And so that has real implications as to if you have a site that really is kind of marginal for sugar maple, but red maple's thriving, it really opens up more possibilities. In addition, you have a more diverse forest. Forest tent caterpillar really does not like red maple at all. So you can have some benefit there. Some other sugar maple specific pests won't find it as hospitable a place to grow. So yeah, red maple definitely is going to be a bigger part of the picture moving forward, especially if the projections and modeling in terms of climate change play out, we're going to see red maple be probably more competitive.
Greg, there aren't too many times we get to say, hey, it's a good thing to have more red maple.
We try not to have biases. Other species, Mark, silver maple, do people tap those?
People do. I would say very limited. The areas that I've seen red maple tapped more than just sort of a novelty would be on sort of riverbank areas where they're large diameter. Really not so much in the areas where maple is really large part of the production, you know, the Northeast, but upper Midwest, I think I've heard of some. It's possible for sure. Any dormant member of the Acer genus, you get the right environmental conditions, you'll get sap.
Watch out, box elders.
So, sorry.
People are doing that. And actually big leaf too. There are some folks out in the Pacific Northwest, both in the U.S. and on the Canadian side, doing big leaf. It can be done. I think there are the potential is there. There's also a huge potential for sugar maple and red maple in areas that already has the infrastructure and knowledge and climate that's really ideal. So not to say that not to discourage people from doing it in other areas, but we're tapping a pretty small fraction of what the potential would be for sugar maple.
So, Brad, don't give up your dreams of living in the bottomlands. So I know that's a place you like. And now a word from our sponsors.
Looking for heavy-duty construction and forestry equipment? Check out McCoy Construction and Forestry, your John Deere dealer. With 16 dealerships spanning the Midwest, McCoy offers new or used construction and forestry equipment, rental, parts and service, and product support. Visit McCoyCF.com and follow them on social media to see what McCoy has to offer.
Today's episode of SilvaCast is also brought to you by...
The Family Forest Carbon Program pays landowners to improve the health of their land and increase the long-term value of their property. The program equips landowners with resources and support to implement sustainable practices that help them reach their goals while also improving the health of their forests and our planet. To learn more about how you can access these benefits for your forests, visit familyforestcarbon.org.
And now back to our show. Before we kind of move on, Mark, just you mentioned something I think is important. I was wondering if you could say something about this survey that you organized of the foresters in the Northeast. What was that you're referring to?
Sure. Yeah. So we received, some colleagues of mine received some funding to look at what's the current status of forest management in maple and what are professional foresters applying in terms of silvicultural prescriptions? What are their concerns? What do they see as the benefits? We published that I can share that link to for folks to read the summary of that work. Largely, we found that foresters who have experience working in sugar bushes tend to prescribe uneven age management, single tree selection, crop tree release tends to be the most common. I would say 80% or more of prescriptions fall under those two categories. And if you think about it, it makes sense. You know, we're a very long-lived species and you can tap individual trees for a very long time. And since the production doesn't drop off, at least we're not seeing the production drop off, the concerns about the financial window or interval in which you would retain a particular crop tree or the health of that tree dropping off over the time just hasn't really been shown. And so the idea of a rotation age for a tapped maple tree is very different than it would be for, say, something you're growing for timber production. Lots of other things came out of that work. I would say that one sort of big one is that when we asked, 98% viewed sugarbush management as a sustainable activity or sustainable land use. And so, although we are extracting something, it was largely viewed as something that was sustainable. And this might be a good time to say, there's a lot of unknowns. You know, there's been so much change in how sap is harvested, the technology, the magnitude of the extraction. It's been really within the last 25 years or so that we've been able to achieve high sap yields consistently. And we are talking about a long-lived tree, and we're talking about a relatively short period. We haven't had individual trees go through their one whole rotation to know, what is the cumulative effect. And I'm part of a project here at the Proctor Maple Research Center, where we have a group of trees that are untapped. They're all sugar maples. They had no previous history of being tapped, which is hard to find in Vermont, but it does exist. And we kept a third untapped, a third we're tapping with more traditional gravity, you might say, practices, and then a third with the highest vacuum possible. And we're 10 years into that project. And so far, we haven't seen a difference in growth, which is one of the primary metrics that we're looking at. And the overall crown condition is similar across those three treatments. So, but again, 10 years, that's a blink of an eye in the life of a sugar maple.
Yeah, I haven't really thought about that. Guess we don't really know what long-term sustainability might look like, in these stands. But I did want to mention that survey because I think it might come up in our conversation.
You know, something you mentioned too from that survey was thinking about the rotations for the trees. I've often said, if I'm going to get a tattoo, it's going to say, we mark trees, but we manage stands. And so are we thinking about sugarbush management as stand level management, or is it really tree level management?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd say by and large, people think about it in terms of trees. When we asked foresters, do you incorporate just a ballpark estimate for yield on a per acre basis when you do your management plans for sugarbushes? 85% said no. I mean, can you imagine a forester saying, no, I'm not really going to make any projections as to how much you're going to grow for other forest products? But with maple, it's not a priority. The other thing that's odd about the maple, the way we talk about maple, is that we talk about it in terms of taps. These are the spouts or the spiles, depending on where you're from, that we actually insert in the tree to get the sap out. Maple loves to talk about how many taps do you have? Oh, I'm just a hobby guy. I've got 5 taps in my backyard. Oh, I'm getting into it. I've got 1,000. Oh, he's a big operation. He's got 10,000 taps. But that's as deep as generally we get in terms of the discussion. It would be like putting up a timber sale and saying, I've got 1,000 trees to sell. That's all you get to know. That it's not enough information to give you a sense of what is the capacity of that stand to produce sap. So ideas of basal area per acre, idea of mean stand diameter, it hasn't really been incorporated yet into common discussions about sugarbush A versus sugarbush B. A little bit, but the research hasn't kept pace to really get us there. So I think in the future, it probably makes more sense to look at on a per acre basis, something where you can assess the basal area of conductive tissue per acre and make sure that it's being managed in a way that you have multiple age classes and you have some regeneration and younger age classes ready to fill in as needed.
Let's try to jump into some of that silviculture nitty gritty. Maybe we don't have all the answers yet. So that's fine. So I was just kind of Like in my little mind, I was thinking of breaking this apart into like maybe the middle stages of developing a sugar bush and sort of the what we would call in traditional forestry practices, tending or the intermediate treatment phase. And you kind of touched on it, Mark. So around that, oftentimes we may thin or manage stands using basal area controls, or we could use like crop tree management sort of philosophy. I take it that the crop tree management sort of technique is probably the more major one that's used.
Definitely. The important thing is to recognize that tree form doesn't really have a huge impact on yield. You can have a fairly gnarly, ugly looking specimen that can be quite productive in terms of sap. Now, if you have structural issues, poor branching, that sort of thing, you're putting effort into retaining a tree that may not last. So that's a separate issue. But in terms of production, the crop tree tends to be the focus.
Kind of going off of that, are there characteristics of sap crop tree that people would use? Or is that just something that well defined?
Well, again, so much has changed in how we collect the sap. It's hard to overemphasize how traditional maple is in people's minds and yet how different it is. Like imagine if you're collecting sap from a tree using gravity. So just buckets, or some people use bags now. Do you want to walk to, even if it meant more sap, do you want to walk to twice as many trees to collect that sap? Or do you want to focus that energy on fewer widely spaced large diameter trees and cut down on the number of buckets or, you know, number of trees you have to go to? So when you look at some of these old stocking guides, the S line, the one for a sugar bush, is pretty, pretty low. And that's really focused on having to carry heavy sap from tree to tree or to some collection point. Now with maple tubing and high vacuum, that labor, you still have to go out and make repairs, but the labor, daily labor of going to harvest the sap and bring it to some point has been dramatically reduced. And so there are real implications in terms of management and what a sugar bush will look like, I think, going forward.
So Greg, that's a really interesting thinking about in terms of intermediate treatments. And so I wonder then the corollary is, so what does that mean for like your natural regeneration systems? So even age, uneven age, it seems to me that's a really a good question for you.
Yeah, definitely uneven aged, I would say, is most common. The vast majority of foresters will tend towards that. Some sites will be better at getting sugar maple or red maple established and seeds germinated. Others not so much, but it is all wild regeneration. There's very little planting done in maple. And I would say that like with just about any tending activity, you can make your best guess as to what the winners are going to be. But if you start doing that too early, you could be surprised. In other words, some really early kind of pre-commercial stuff might be asking for trouble when the trees haven't really sorted out dominance yet. And you don't necessarily want to pick a winner when the fitness of that individual hasn't really been established and whether or not they're going to really thrive on that site. So I guess I'm thinking like really small pole size. I think it's a little dangerous to start doing that too early.
I think that was a concern among foresters. Regeneration, maybe sugar bush managers weren't necessarily considering regeneration and that long-term sustainability. They were more looking at that shorter time window.
Yeah, I mean, the question was fairly open-ended in terms of what their primary concerns were. Regeneration is a large, large topic, right? So was it regeneration because the landowner or the sugar maker isn't interested in putting in money to make sure that there's adequate regeneration? Or is it that things are changing and we're having a harder time, even with support from the landowner or the sugar maker, we're having a hard time regenerating that? You know, we're not seeing a ton of it yet, but invasive earthworms are a big concern about regeneration, digesting all that, the leaf material, making it harder for sugar maple to germinate, various things, ferns are an issue, other invasive species. So, you know, with surveys, you don't want to overwhelm folks. So we didn't go too deep into the specifics about why regeneration was really one of the top concerns, but I have to imagine some of the things I just mentioned were part of that.
Yeah. So all the same northern hardwood regeneration issues we're having in lots of places is no different in the sugar bush. I kind of took it reading too that foresters were thinking that maybe they had to work with those landowners to say, you really need to consider regeneration and for the long-term sustainability of your sugar bush, because your trees are going to have to have some kind of replacements at some point.
Yes. And, you know, the sugar maker community is not uniform. So there are certainly plenty that are concerned and are doing what it takes to foster the next generation. But I think you're right. I think the foresters might be concerned about some of that. And even, you know, it can be difficult sometimes to have a conversation to say, well, you're going to have to cut this tree, and it might be a maple, in order to release what looks to be a really good, healthy, small grouping of young sugar maples to thrive for the next generation. Historically, that can be a challenging conversation. So I would agree that's probably where some of that concern is coming from.
I would think the corollary to that would be thinking about ecological forestry in that same context, like maybe leaving other species or maybe other, like, you know, snags or trees to become snags or things like that. Is there any discussion about kind of that relationship of ecological forestry and maple syrup production?
There is. I would say the vast majority, it comes up in terms of certified organic maple operations, which is a relatively new thing in terms of the history of maple. We are seeing a huge growth, and that's largely driven by consumer demand for organic food products in general, and they want to see an organic maple option. And there's a bunch of different certifiers depending on where you are. It's a fairly low barrier to getting certified. Primarily, it means a forest management plan that meets the minimum for that certifier. In Vermont, I can say it basically has to align with the Vermont property tax abatement program that we call current use. I'm sure it's different in other states, but it has to meet minimum standards about good forestry. So you have to have that. And then there's almost always a diversity component. So in a lot of the plans, they want to have at least 25% non-sugar maple retained in that sugar bush. Our previous conversation about red maple would make sense now, because you can include red maple as that part of that diversity component. And so what we're seeing is more red maples being tapped. We're seeing the demand for organic syrup has gone up. So I would say when you, not necessarily number of operations, but total crop size, we're getting close to 75% of all the syrup is certified organic. And that's because large operations are able to get this certification, get the premium on their product, and get the benefit of that increased price without a huge amount of work on the forestry side.
On a more basic level, is there a benefit to the sap production in having not all maple trees in the stand?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, lots of work outside of maple has been done to show that a more diverse forest is going to be more resilient to forest pests, likely to be more resilient to issues of erratic weather. You also have the ability to be a better site for bird species and other wildlife. So yeah, I think there are lots of benefits that go along with certified organic.
I'm curious too. So we're used to working with just like the, you know, FSC, SFI kind of, or thinking about that type of certification. So now organic is almost a new level. How would they deal? And maybe you guys in Vermont don't have to deal with invasives too much like we do here, but how would they approach invasives in that context?
Right. So unfortunately we do have to deal with invasives. You know, we see issues with buckthorn. We see, you know, issues with a little bit of barberry, some other honeysuckle, all sorts of stuff. Always concerns about invasive insects as well. Again, it'll kind of depend on the individual certifier, what they're willing to allow and not allow in terms of dealing with invasives. Some will allow a bit of chemical treatment, but you have to do a buffer and you have to deal with it in a very upfront way and describe how other strategies have been tried and not worked, or, you know, why you have to go this route. So an exclusion area around areas where you're going to be treating. Obviously, mechanical removal is possible, but it's super expensive and time consuming and not always effective. So kind of depends on the individual certifier, much like some certifiers allow whole tree harvesting in the sugar bush wall, whereas others don't. So there can be some diversity in terms of what one certifier allows versus another. And landowners or sugar makers will have to make their decision based on what their goals are.
You had mentioned, I don't know, in Vermont, your kind of tax basis program. We have a similar managed forest law in Wisconsin. And so there, People have to figure out a balance between, say, forest product production and if they're going to do tapping. So is there a balance between, say, sugar bush management and managing for, say, quality timber? Are those two compatible?
That's a great question. So I'm most familiar with the Vermont program, and I know that it may be different. Like you said, it's different in other states.
Yeah.
In Vermont, first of all, there's two ways you could enroll your land. You could enroll it in forest management and have to do the forest management plan. And if you're doing maple, you have to adhere to the guideline maple. You could also enroll it in agriculture and have no forest management plan. And really, other than a map to show where the sugar bush is, really no other requirements for enrolling it. The downside on that is that you pay twice as much. The minimum assessment for that acre is about twice for agriculture as it is for forest management. It's still a reduction, but it's twice as much. So most people would enroll in forestry, the forestry side. Within the guidelines for Vermont, there is a requirement that the ratio of what's called acceptable growing stock to unacceptable growing stock has to be maintained, even though you're enrolling it in terms of sugar bush and sap collection. So in other words, acceptable growing stock is really a term for tree form and its potential to make, you know, good, clear logs. As we've mentioned already, that term doesn't really exist in a formal way for maple, because you can have a very gnarly, twisted, but alive and still productive tree that could be tapped for years and years. It will never make more than firewood on the timber side. And so Vermont has decided, the state of Vermont has decided that ratio needs to stay basically the same. You can't enroll a parcel of forest land in sugar bush management and then have it trend towards a lot of trees with poor form. That ratio of acceptable to unacceptable has to stay the same, which is that was intentional. They decided that was what needed to happen, even though you could argue that assumes that eventually someone is going to cut that tree down for timber production, which is a presumption, you know, because a lot of sugar makers are multi-generation. They were producing syrup before, they're going to be producing it now, and they're going to be producing it in the future. And they are not intending to ever cut those trees down. They're going to tap them for as long as they can and have trees waiting in the wings to fill in the gap when that tree dies. So it's a great question. Yeah. I think it actually is a debate and a discussion that needs to happen more, because again, we're talking about a very different product.
Do some producers ever segregate, like trees that they may be growing for timber purposes versus their sap production trees? So maybe they have some veneer quality logs within the stand and I'm not going to tap those. I'm going to manage them differently.
I mean, I guess it's theory and practice, right? Like I've heard of people saying that they're going to exclude a few because they look really good and they could be veneer. In my mind, my analogy is like, you know, is every baseball card you have a Roberto Clemente rookie card? No, yeah. You know, it's you don't know what it's worth until it's on the ground and a veneer buyer cuts you a check. Yeah. So I think there is a way to do both. I think it's in practice less common than you might think. You could flag a few, just not tap them. You'd have to have a pretty good idea of what that previous land use was all about. You know, has it have a period of tapping? Is there a bunch of non-conductive stained wood that's in there? You just can't see it because the tree has had a whole generation, human generation, of not tapping to obscure that. And then when you actually get to the point where you think you're going to have a payday in terms of a veneer tree, you don't.
Yeah. So, and it adds to that long-term complexity of trying to manage that becomes very difficult.
I would say the big issue with modern maple and forest management, we've already talked about a lot, but the infrastructure for harvesting sap using tubing does present some impediments, some physical impediments to access, and can reduce the amount of tending activities that occur. It doesn't have to, but it can. And some of it could be just laying out the tubing in a little more thoughtful way to allow for access, or pairing up your rotation of your tending activities with a replacement of the tubing so that there's a period where that tubing is not as present. It's been taken down, or parts of it have been taken down to allow for access. So that it just takes another level of engagement with, okay, what's the plan? Can we get those two cycles aligned? Can there be flexibility so that we wait a little longer, maybe on the tending, or maybe replace the tubing a little bit sooner than maybe you were planning on? It just takes that extra level of planning, which can be challenging. Hmm.
One thing I had read about too is it seems like roads. So maybe that was a difference too between the historic way we did things and now maybe roads aren't as important as they were historically, just getting into the stands.
I would say roads are still quite important.
Still, okay.
And if you think about it, here's another point at which there can be some friction between, you know, the forestry community that's used to a longer rotation between entries with probably heavier equipment, but fewer entries over the lifetime or the plan's lifetime, versus maple, where you have maybe even daily entries, but with light equipment. So four-wheelers, side-by-sides, maybe snowmobiles in the deep snow, but you're having lots of access. And so it's really important that you're managing your roads in a way that can handle that kind of traffic and managing the water, you know, making sure that your water bars, broad-based dips, culverts are appropriately sized now and in the future. That's really important. I mean, no one likes to get stuck in the mud, but in addition to that, you have the real consequences in terms of water quality with repeated entries during what can be a pretty sensitive time. You've got a lot of moisture in the ground during late winter, early spring. We don't have to go out and collect the sap every day like we used to with horses or tractors, but you still, if you want to be productive and achieve high yields, you do have to be out there every day making repairs. Squirrels, wind damage, just general maintenance has to be done to achieve those high yields. And so, yeah, being thoughtful, abandoning historical roads that really were nothing more than expediency, that didn't really look at water quality, giving those up, putting them on a more gentle slope, doing the important grading and all those other issues that cost money and take time, that's really important.
So there's a lot of things to consider here between this intersection of trying to make, say, traditional timber management and sap production compatible. Another thing I was thinking of, has there been any work done around tap injuries? Like, what does that mean in terms of timber quality to these trees? Or does it present any kind of other long-term health risk?
So sugar maple, we have the most data on sugar maple. We don't have quite as much about red maple for all the historical reasons I mentioned, you know, that was actively excluded from sugar bushes. So there wasn't as much research done. Sugar maple is very good at compartmentalizing, you know, so that combination of active and passive processes that wall off injury. And, you know, pioneered by Alex Shigo, you know, the idea that you're making a barrier to systemic infection. Sugar maple is very good at compartmentalizing. And so that really discrete wound that we make with the drill bit when we're tapping every year, sugar maples in by and large are really good at compartmentalizing that wound. And we don't see a real issue long term. That being said, the intensity of tapping, so how many taps per tree and the location of where those taps are put, you can potentially have an issue if you're following really nothing more than folklore, you know, always tap on the south side of the tree or always tap over a big root. These things that endure in people's minds as like, this is how you sugar, that aren't really rooted in scientific understanding. And what you end up with, you get a clustering of wounds, you end up with a larger wound than you would otherwise by spacing it out. The other issue with tapping with vacuum and tubing is that you're able to access a much larger volume. If you think about the band of tapping, so above and below where the lateral line, the tubing that goes to each tree, you can actually, we found through our research, you can tap below the lateral line and get just as much sap as you would above. But historically, no one would ever do that. It would look, you know, if you drove past your neighbor and all the spouts were below, you'd think, I don't know, are they okay? You know, that doesn't really look right. But when you actually do the work, measure the volume throughout a season, we see you get about the same amount of sap. And what you've done now is effectively doubled the amount of conductive wood you can tap into, which has real implications in terms of sustainability. So the using old tapping guidelines that are really rooted in bucket sap collection with modern tubing, you are multiplying the amount of internal wounding. You know, we recommend one tap per tree up to about 18 inches to 20 inches in diameter, no more than two. And really that second one should, lots of things have to be checked off the list. Really adequate radial growth, really good sight. Not every 18-inch tree deserves a second spout.
And they might be compartmentalizing those wounds well, Mark. How about staining, though? Like if we're managing for timber, again, color in maple is very important. Is that an issue?
Well, I would argue that if you're tapping trees for maple, you're tapping trees for maple. You know, I think some may say eventually I might cut these trees down, but you're making a decision that anything that has the influence of a spout is going to have some staining. And there's a huge amount of variability. So if you take the, let's consider the volume of the drill hole you make every year. So we call that the tap hole. Mm-hmm. Just imagine that three-dimensional volume of that drill bit. So it's 5/16 of an inch is now the standard. And about 1.5 to 2 inches deep is the industry standard. So you get a picture of three-dimensional volume. Again, my colleague, Dr. Abby Vandenberg, has quantified by cutting trees down and actually measuring the three-dimensional volume, the whole stain, the stuff that not just the drill hole, but what goes above and below, that could be anything from maybe 20 times the tap hole size in terms of volume to almost over 100 times. It's so variable. And so some trees are just going to be better at compartmentalizing than others. It's really hard to say, but I would, in practice, the logger is just going to lop off the bottom wherever that staining begins. And if that tree is cut for timber, there's going to be that loss. I will say the annual income from sap and syrup production, there's a lot of stability in that price right now, in terms, given how the Quebec system is structured and their market share. We know that maple production using good practices is going to outperform timber over the long term. It's just the way it's held up as being consistent. And so whether someone chooses to cut their sugar bush down, that's their individual choice. I would say most producers that I deal with, if they're doing maple, they're doing maple. They're not waiting until their tree gets big enough or at some point that they're going to cut it down.
I was thinking too, is like you talked about common natural regeneration method being single tree selection. So at some point in that method, they would be rotating certain trees out of the stand. So there would be trees that were tapped, which would now be harvested for saw logs. So kind of that intersection between the two.
Yeah, Greg, I just don't think that happens. And honestly, I think people who tap trees, they're going to keep tapping them until the tree dies. In fact, I haven't even really seen, you know, maybe on an individual tree basis, there might be some recommendations in a prescription to say these really large decadent trees that have had serious decay, that they would be removed. But those would likely not be a candidate for producing clear logs anyway. So I think in general, trees that are tapped are going to be tapped for the long term.
So thinking about trees and kind of that mortality, it makes me think, and maybe just for our Eastern listeners or maybe Eastern United States. So thinking about threats on the horizon, because I could imagine like, oh, what if now I start to lose my maples? Now I really have a problem because I haven't set myself up. Is there anything out here? We're kind of on the outside looking in at spotter and lanternfly. Is there anything known about maples and lanternfly yet?
I believe sugar maple is up there in terms of host trees that it will impact. So I think sugar maple is right up near the top. Not as high as tree of heaven, but it's definitely right up there. In Vermont, we haven't seen it. There was one interception, but it was probably just an individual or two that was caught in a shipping container. But I think the closest outbreak might be Pennsylvania to us at this point. It's not a huge part of my work, so I don't have a ton of intimate knowledge about that. But I mean, we could take threats all the way from, is sugar maple going to be competitive in 100 years based on climate change, to what appears to be a more frequent erratic storm events that are happening right now. And so everything along that continuum, I think, is on the table as far as threats going forward. Asian longhorn beetle has gotten a lot of attention, and yet it does appear that a lot of the money that was spent is paying off, combined with the insects' sort of lack of initiative to really spread. Yeah. You know, they're able to do a pretty good job containing that. So I think it's still a threat, still a concern, but both the money spent by the federal government to do some containment or to do a lot of containment and eradication of infected trees, it doesn't get quite as much attention. Emerald ash borer, not obviously a concern for maple species, but ash is a big part of northern hardwoods, and so there's a real risk having those wiped out. Drought is a big one. Drought doesn't get quite as much attention, I think, as it should. You can have obviously some symptoms of drought, but they're not as dramatic as, say, a windstorm or an ice storm. But it has real, real serious impacts on growth and prolonged drought for tree health and the ability to photosynthesize. And so I think drought deserves more attention than it gets, mostly just because the symptoms tend to be a little bit harder to see.
Well, this has been a great conversation, Mark. Where should, if foresters are interested in more about sugarbush management, where should they look?
Oh, we've got a bunch of materials available. Everything from a series of really short 2-minute videos about different aspects of sugarbush management you can find on the YouTube for the Proctor Maple Research Center. We also have a website called maplemanager.org. This is a mixture of forestry and business related tools and resources. So check out maplemanager.org. And then I'll say that a lot of the work that we do gets published in sort of the gray literature, and a lot of that can be found at mapleresearch.org. There's a lot of forestry stuff, some historical, I'll say, and some more modern. You can check that out. And I'm always available and interested in having chats. So if people want to reach out to me specifically, that's great. And the website that I help maintain, if you just search for UVM Extension Maple, you'll find a bunch of resources there.
Great. So if foresters are looking for silvicultural guidance, would they find that in some of that research?
Yeah, there just hasn't been that much work, Greg, unfortunately. You know, the issue is, like I said before, we're dealing with a perennial plant that's tapped for decades and decades and decades. There just hasn't been a whole lot of focus on the silvicultural side of maple production. And so what you'll find mostly is some Forest Service documents from a while ago talking about management, and then some just more articles, conversations. We have some webinars talking a bit more in depth about like issues that we've talked about today. But in terms of research saying, here's the approach and this is what you're going to get for it, we need more. We need more work on that area. And I definitely would recommend folks who hear something about that that's captivating and they want to put some research focus onto it, I'd be happy to be involved in trying to help that discussion bear some fruit.
Sounds like we all just need to live a little longer, watch trees a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Well, and Brad, more opportunities for silvicultural trials, at least on an informal basis, to try some things out and monitor what those effects are.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I'll say, and I'm surprised we didn't come up already, but one of the real challenges is with tubing systems, you have all these trees connected to this system and you lose that individual tree knowledge of how much an individual tree is producing. You know, here at the research center, we have separate vacuum chambers attached to each individual tree. So we get good data, but there's a huge amount of money and time invested in making that happen. And so by and large, the focus has been on how to maximize yields over the last 30 years. The idea of thinning and trying to see the signal from that thinning poses some real challenges, especially if you try to get replication to show that what you're actually seeing is accurate. The infrastructure, the science behind it, it's not just for lack of interest. It's a challenging thing.
Real. More to come.
Mark, I thank you for coming and talking with us today. Like I said, this is like a longstanding issue for me dealing with landowners and just going, I'm not sure what my best advice is. So it just helps me start thinking about that topic.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Yeah, thanks, Brad and Greg, for inviting me. And there's more, obviously, plenty more to talk about in the future.
Yep.
Yeah, great stuff. More to come.
Take care. That music can only mean it's time for the Dropbox, the Dropbox is a regular segment where we take your comments, questions, tips, and share them with our listeners.
Greg, this week we received a question in the Dropbox from Rich in Merrill, and this relates to Northern Hardwoods and Northern Hardwoods management. Rich is curious about the difference between single tree selection and some of the age class conversion techniques that we use as a part of Northern Hardwood management.
Oh, how many hours do we have, Brad?
Well, I was going to say, how many beers do we need for this one? But let's just say there is a difference, right? So, and I'll start this off. So I'm thinking basically, so the age class, and so we're really talking about here is taking even age stands and converting them to uneven age stands. And so oftentimes it might be going to something like single tree selection, or historically we may be focused on single tree selection, but really we're talking about just that big pool of uneven age, kind of like here are the ways we could work with this, correct?
Yeah. I mean, if I boil this down to the simplest terms and I think about our silviculture guidelines and the Wisconsin Silviculture Guide is the conversion process. And in this case, when we refer to the conversion process, we're talking about even to uneven age conversion.
Correct.
So we're
correct.
Trying to move Northern Hardwood stands from even aged to uneven aged through this creation of new cohorts of regeneration, but also tending the stand and then trying to get it to three or more age classes. That's just our definition of uneven aged.
Correct.
But when I talk single tree selection, that's a system we're applying to an already uneven aged stand, and we're tending and rotating different three or more age classes simultaneously in that stand. So that's, to me, is the essence of the difference between the two.
Yeah. And then you have the size distribution that you have as a target,
right,
as a part of single tree selection, versus you don't really have that. You're just looking for diversity and kind of that the age classes themselves, but it may not be reflected in like a curve that we would see in something like a single tree selection.
To me, that's the short and the long answer. And there is more information in our Wisconsin Silviculture Guide.
Greg, I think Mark did a nice job of boiling down a lot of information into our talk. We really tapped into some sweet info on maple syrup silviculture. Sure, it started or might have gotten a little sappy, but I thought we held it together pretty well. And this reminds me, Mary told me to put maple syrup on the grocery list. There must be a trick to carrying a sticky piece of paper into the grocery store.
Oh. Brad, I expect nothing, and I'm still let down.
In any event, thanks for listening to today's episode of Silvacast. If you have ideas for future episodes or a question for the Dropbox, please let us know. We learn best when we wrestle with questions, so keep them coming.
And take care, everyone. And as always, thanks to our team, Susan Barrett, our editor-in-chief, Logan Badon, IT Master, theme music by Paul Frater, and of course, UW-Stevens Point's Wisconsin Forestry Center.